Okay, well, thanks everybody for coming to this first of what ought to be six graduate seminars, which we're running across these two semesters. The first part of that program is themed around animals and ecology. So we're interested in getting people in to talk about kind of recent developments in particularly things like critical animal studies and post-colonial eco-criticism. And our first speaker in this programme is Dominic O'Key. He's a PhD candidate in German and comparative literature at the University of Leeds, where he's working on a Leverhulme Trust-funded project on trauma and world literatures. And he's just begun work on a research project on W.G. Sebald and J.M. Coetzee. And today he'll be talking to us about animal biography, the Anthropocene, Bernard Stiegler, and the final 5 minutes of Werner Herzog's film Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Well, thanks, Luke, for inviting me. So the piece I'm sort of presenting today comes out of my MA dissertation. It is the final chapter, and it is quite substantially revised and wrenched away from the other contextual parts, which sort of make it approachable. So it's I'm not sure if it stands alone, but you guys can be the judges of that. But before I get going, I'll just maybe say a few bits about the film itself. For those who are unaware, Werner Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams is a 3D documentary. It came out in 2010. And it takes as its subject matter the Chauvet Cave in southeast France. Now, the cave is home to a veritable archive of over 400 Upper Paleolithic paintings. And it was discovered in 1994 before being promptly sealed off to the public. Radiocarbon dating approximates that the cave's collections of paintings, handprints, and non-human animal bones date back to around 30,000 before present. The Chauvet Cave is hence unique in that it houses the oldest known volume of extant figurative art. Afforded restricted but nevertheless unprecedented access to the cave, as well as its team of multidisciplinary researchers, Werner Herzog casts his typically auteurist eye across the cave's topography and, in turn, meditates on several of the critical problematics of his wider filmography. So from Aguirre, The Wrath of God in 1972, all the way up to, for instance, Into the Abyss, 2011, the German director's work has unfolded sort of contesting ontologies. It probes humanity's conceptual limits within and often against the natural world. With this, I'm thinking of an essay by Nat Pick in particular, which he talks about his work. So with this ontological concentration in mind, the question that Herzog himself puts to his final interviewee in this film becomes quite redolent. He asks him, what constitutes humanness? So in the wider dissertation, what I'm doing is I'm sort of arguing that the film itself conceives of the human along the lines that Herzog gets an answer from the director of the cave, who's called Jean-Michel Genest. This man. So he stumbles over his English, but in doing so, he kind of proclaims that the human is that being that both inscribes and speculates. So for Genest, what makes us uniquely human is that we paint, so it's a form of inscription, but also that we ask why we paint, so we sort of speculate on that practice. So I was sort of arguing throughout my piece that Herzog's film engages with the Chauvet cave and its art as inscriptions that mark, demarcate, or perhaps carve out an ontology for humanity within the world. And concurrently, Herzog also suggests that our perennial fascination with artifacts, our very speculations on our origins, similarly constitute a distinctive mode of being. So in this sense, Herzog's film echoes Georges Bataille's reading of the Lascaux Cave. So this is a cave which was discovered in 1940 during the occupation of France by the Nazis. Bataille writes in a lecture that the cave is the measure of the world. But it is a separate Bataille text, and indeed a separate part of Herzog's film I'm going to be focusing on today. I'm talking, of course, about the postscript, an odd and quite memorable sign-off for an equally odd and memorable film. Before I get there, though, I'm going to begin with Bataille. In a 1955 lecture on the Lascaux Cave, Bataille begins by unifying both humanity's origin and its end in one rhetorical gesture. This is at the end of the quotation. "I am simply struck by the fact that light is being shed on our birth at the very moment when the notion of our death appears to us." So, struck by a sort of crashing together of temporalities, Bataille's optical metaphors compound the deep time of prehistory with the imminent danger of catastrophe in the present. Contemporaneous to the early Cold War years and their unfolding debates about mutually assured destruction, Bataille's lecture dwells momentarily on the likelihood of the apocalypse, this, what he calls elsewhere, prospect of absolute death. He finds here a disquieting connection, a fundamental connection, between two antithetical temporalities, between the past and the present. Indeed, Bataille warns his audience that they are at an exceptional turning point in history. It is, for him, as if the Lascaux paintings themselves indicate the advent and the disappearance of humanity. The cave itself signifies both cradle and coffin. Of course, this book is called The Cradle of Humanity, after one of his lectures. Bataille returns to such a compelling coupling of the birth and death of the Anthropos in a short piece in the same collection, titled Unlivable Earth. And I think maybe some of these debates are actually quite pertinent to today with the ecological state. But here he again speaks of two interrelated dangers. First, the possibility of an immense ecological collapse. Second, nuclear warfare. Taking a panoramic view of the catastrophe, Bataille writes anxiously that there is something frightful in human destiny, which undoubtedly was always at the limit of this unlimited nightmare that the most modern weaponry, the nuclear bomb, finally announces. So the bomb here is taken to be a performative harbinger of the apocalypse, a radioactive speech act at the very limits of imagination, that through the announcement of its presence becomes a nightmare of humanity's future. To borrow Jacques Derrida's typically suggestive and here even quite camp phrasing, Bataille's bomb is envisioned as being fabulously textual. It is humanity's last word. And yet, as Derrida also reminds us, this in No Apocalypse Not Now, Full Speed Ahead, there is a pertinent question to be asked of the nuclear epoch from which Bataille is writing. Is the bomb, as Derrida asks, in fact, a new phenomenon, or is it rather the brutal acceleration of a movement that has always already been at work? That is, as a material that is concomitant with the horizon of time and the speed of technics, the bomb might not be too dissimilar to the history of a sort of Stieglerian technics itself, and by that I mean Bernard Stiegler's thesis in Technics and Time, that the who and the what, that is, the human and the technical, are co-constitutive. The human co-originates with the birth of technics. So, not a new phenomenon then, but one that has always already been at work, the bomb here becomes a metonym for technics as such. The bomb is technics, and the nuclear age, turning our heads towards the future, is to be understood as an absolute and fabulous text of technics. In this sense, technics might also be described as a pharmakon, that is, what Derrida and Stiegler, following Plato, articulate as being both the remedy and the poison of the who. Stiegler's technics ensures the originary and continued birthing of the human to reproduce, but such a working equally brings about the risk of an extinction. This, perhaps, is why Bataille's coupling of the birth and the death of humanity is quite so tantalising. Owing to such a formulation, we would do well to remember Stiegler's claim at the outset of the first volume of Technics and Time that, to quote, "Technics evolves more quickly than culture, causing time to consequently leap outside itself," end quote. Simply put, although Technics co-originates with the human, that is the who, it is imperative to understand Technics as permanently and, for Stiegler, necessarily ahead of the human. This is why, in an interview of Angularchy, Stiegler states that he is not interested in man, but rather in temporality. To quote, "Even when man is finished, when he belongs to the past, this form of life may well continue on, becoming ever more complex." And then he says, "And perhaps man is already finished." So, in other words, a post-human world is never post-technics. And where I'm going with this is that a post-human world is this never post-script. It's not surprising that Stiegler, like Bataille, in fact uses the Lascaux cave to solidify his point. This comes in the third volume of Technics and Time, in which Stiegler writes a short subchapter entitled "The Terrifying Fragility of the Marvelous." Here, Stiegler puts it that the Lascaux cave paintings disclose a... is it quite small? Can you read it? Okay, sorry. They disclose a disturbing vastness to modern audiences. What Stiegler's doing here is he's sort of talking about what he terms an immense we. This is a humanity which goes from the past to the present to the future. But this is a we which is kind of disturbed by Technics as it leaps ahead of itself. But what he means by this disturbing vastness is that the presence of the paintings not only unfold a sort of temporal gulf that unifies prehistory and the present, but the paintings also orient us towards a vastness that necessarily succeeds us. So, Technics, like the paintings, announced the end of the who. And such a claim, I think, probably works to sort of decenter the Anthropos and anticipate a post-human future. Now, a discussion elsewhere would be whether that, for Stiegler, can achieve anything. But I'll leave that there. Stiegler's future, though, I think, finds some sort of articulation in Herzog's postscript. But before I show that postscript, I do think it's worth mentioning, albeit briefly, that there have been some articles published on Cave of Forgotten Dreams so far, many of which aren't very good. Throughout the handful, there is only partial mention of the film's postscript, and mostly what they do is they interpret the postscript as being a sort of idiosyncratic epigram, a sort of Herzogian spiel. Catherine Lord describes it as humorous and capricious, and many of us have sort of have given it their own one paragraph within their articles to sort of just say, "There are some alligators," or "There are some crocodiles." But what I'm doing is taking it quite seriously. And thinking of it as a postscript, I'm sort of thinking about the formal device of tacking it onto the end. And when I was watching it, I realised that it might be sort of good to call it a coda, stylistically. So understanding a coda to be something which is independent from what's come before, but even so, it develops in its own way the main motifs of a given movement. I'm reading this conclusion as simultaneously contingent but also distinct. And quite fittingly, the etymological roots of coda take us to the Latin cordat. If I'm pronouncing that rightly, I don't know Latin, but it means the tail of an animal. So my use of the word post-human, by the way, is intended to invoke a sort of multiplicity of meanings associated with the term. Post-humanism as a speculative temporality after the human, post-human or post-humanism as a theoretical critique of humanism, and as one of its main proponents, Carrie Wolf, writes, post-human as an increase in the vigilance, responsibility and humility that accompany living in a world so newly and differently inhabited. Wolf's influential strain of post-humanism also puts it that the concept comes both before and after the human. So to quote Wolf, before in the sense that it names the embodiment and embeddedness of the human being, not just its biological but also its technical world, after in the sense that post-humanism names a historical moment in which the decentering of the human by its imbrication in technical, medical, informatic, and economic networks is increasingly impossible to ignore. So rather than transcending the human, and that would be someone who, you know, to transcend the human would be something that Wolf would critique in this book. Wolf's post-humanism requires us to attend to the human with a sort of greater specificity and greater attention to its embodiment. Even so, this is not to say that Herzog's postscript offers its own embodiment of Wolf's post-humanism. Indeed, part of the reason that I'm sort of focusing on this postscript so closely is that it voices a contradictory and labile truth. To use Wolf's terms, I'm attesting that Herzog's postscript is an articulation of post-humanism's good and bad problematics. It both does the transcendence and the embodiment. But even so, I think that the postscript concurrently equips us with some, at least some, of the vigilance, responsibility, and humility that Wolf calls for. So, after that introduction, if the sound's working, let's just watch the postscript.
On the Rhône River is one of the largest nuclear power plants in France. The Chauvet Cave is located only 20 miles as a crow flies beyond these hills in the background. A surplus of warm water, which has been used to cool these reactors, is diverted half a mile away to create a tropical biosphere. Warm steam fills enormous greenhouses, and the site is expanding. Crocodiles have been introduced into this brooding jungle, and warmed by water to cool the reactor, man, do they thrive. There are already hundreds of them. Not surprisingly, mutant albinos swim and breed in these waters. A thought is born of this surreal environment. Not long ago, just a few 10,000s of years back, there were glaciers here 9,000 feet thick. And now a new climate is steaming and spreading. Fairly soon these albinos might reach Chauvet Cave. Looking at the paintings, what will they make of them? Nothing is real. Nothing is certain. It is hard to decide whether or not these creatures here are dividing into their own doppelgangers. And do they really meet, or is it just their own imaginary mirror reflection? Are we today, possibly, the crocodiles who look back into an abyss of time? When we see the paintings of Chauvet Cave.
Before I go on, I'd just like to say that near the end, you can sort of see Herzog's hand in the reflection of the glass. And as I was researching for this, I came across an article online which someone was really annoyed that they could see his hand as if it was bad filmmaking. I thought it was really, really funny. But anyway, so it's the end of the film and the screen fades to black and this word postscript appears in thin white typography. Herzog cuts to a cloudy, windy scene with two nuclear cooling towers across the water. The third one he'll pan to. As waste heat is exhaled into the atmosphere, Herzog, you know, pans the camera from left to right and halting... Got an email. As he finds the third cooling tower. And his narration begins. So I'm going to read them out again. On the Rhône River is one of the largest nuclear power plants in France. The Chauvet Cave is located only 20 miles as the crow flies beyond these hills in the background. A surplus of warm water, which has been used to cool these reactors, is diverted half a mile away to create a tropical biosphere. So with the camera's focus on this power plant in the background, Herzog opens the postscript with an assemblage of competing visual elements. The foreground and bottom of the screen is dominated by these thin branches that wave back and forth in the wind. Just up from them, and detectable through their slits, is also the grey-blue river. Above these is the power plant itself and the mountains just visible in the background. But quite interestingly, above them is the sky mixed with contrails from airplanes, water vapour from the nuclear plants, and some natural clouds. So, this is a sort of mixture of both natural and artificial. And in Herzog's first sentence, the power plant itself is brought into contact with lots of these elements. In fact, Herzog's diegetic prose is adding a sort of linguistic depth to the scene's interplay of natural and artificial imagery. So you have the power plant coming into contact with the Rhône River. You have, in the second sentence, the power plant linked to the film's prior focus, the Chauvet Cave. And in the third and final sentence, the power plant connects to this tropical biosphere. Herzog's three declarative sentences ground the viewer in the postscript's change of pace, change of direction. And with this in mind, we notice the primacy of geography, space and place, this formulation. Herzog's establishing shot locates us on the river, some 20 miles as the crow flies from the Chauvet Cave, before diverting half a mile away. So what he's doing here is guiding us to this coda, to this new place. Once he's done that, here we are, half a mile away, supposedly, inside this tropical biosphere. He continues, warm steam fills enormous greenhouses, and the site is expanding. Crocodiles have been introduced into this brooding jungle, and, warmed by water to cool the reactors, man do they thrive. There are already hundreds of them. As we can see, there are not hundreds of them. It's probably about 20. But here, menacing music starts to reverberate. As the camera is kind of led through this brooding jungle. And here I'm sort of reminded of... Herzog's is it in Burden of Dreams, Les Blanc's documentary about Fitzcarraldo, in which there's a very famous scene in which he says the jungle is obscene, and he's got, you know, these plants around him and he says it's all death. But so what's happening here is an approach to these crocodiles from an elevated walkway, spotting a group of them. And then finally, he cuts the third and final time to this small albino alligator, which rises out of the water, snaps its jaws. And here is the narrative conclusion. And I think, again, this bears repeating. Not surprisingly, mutant albinos swim and breed in these waters. A thought is born of this surreal environment. Not long ago, just a few 10,000s of years back, there were glaciers here 9,000 feet thick. And now a new climate is steaming and spreading. Fairly soon, these albinos might reach Chauvet Cave. Looking at the paintings, what will they make of them? Nothing is real. Nothing is certain. It is hard to decide whether or not these creatures here are dividing into their own doppelgangers. And do they really meet, or is it just their own imaginary mirror reflection? Are we today possibly the crocodiles who look back into an abyss of time when we see the paintings of Chauvet Cave? So as the music swells and grows more melodic at the end, so too does Herzog's narration. It complicates temporalities by looking to the past, the present, and the future. So that is not long ago and now, fairly soon. It deploys some sort of rhetorical devices like anaphora and erotema. So nothing is real, nothing is certain. The questions. And also its vocabulary and phrasing is quite vibrant, even if occasionally clunky. Are we today? Possibly. At just over 200 words, this short monologue is equivocal and satiric, mysterious and profound, even sonorous, even stupid, but it is an enigmatic and typically Herzogian ending to the film. And that's probably the only thing that critics who've written about this get right. It is Herzogian. There is, however, much more to unfold from such a mysterious conclusion. Yes, with its rhetorical gestures and falling cadences, it does a lot of sort of linguistic work, but layered over the misty visuals and reverberating cello soundtrack, it's quite unsurprising that it's sort of bewildered some critics so far. Herzog's lapidary formulations are quite overdetermined. They pose antinomies and interrogatives that seem deliberately obfuscating. So first, to understand as much as we can this conclusion, it's first crucial to acknowledge quite a contextual factor, which is the scene is quite a typical performance of Herzog's infamous directorial technique of what he calls fabrication and imagination and stylization. This is outlined in his 2001 manifesto, the Minnesota Declaration. So this fabrication and imagination and stylization, let's see it in action. So to explain, there is relatively little factual stuff to this postscript. This tropical biosphere is not a tropical biosphere. It's actually a theme park for kids. It's not half a mile away from the Chauvet Cave or the power plant. It's actually 20 miles away. So this brooding jungle is a sort of place for kids to go and look at crocodiles. Nothing more. But perhaps most important in this sort of fakery and this fabulation is Herzog's representation of these mutant albino crocodiles, who are firstly not crocodiles but alligators, and secondly, as I'm going to discuss, their mutation is not a mutation at all, or at least not in the way that Herzog reads it. So, the postscript willfully fabricates its truth as part of Herzog's ongoing critique of cinema verite. As Herzog comments in a recently published collection of interviews, this is with Paul Cronin, called A Guide for the Perplexed. He says, "The line between fiction and documentary doesn't exist for me. My documentaries are often fictions in disguise." So it is exactly from this position that Herzog is able to conceive of such a speculative fiction. Herzog's falsification and misrepresentation are intrinsic to his aesthetic and, in many films, ethical strategies, particularly for his documentaries. And I would like to locate the albino alligator as here the central figure in this formulation. This is because Herzog's postscript utilises the alligator as both a material and an abstract marker. And this is something that Akira Mizuta-Lippitt has elsewhere called an animetaphor, not in reference to the albino alligator, but in reference to literary animals. Namely, they are both a metaphor and flesh within the text. They exhibit, for instance, Moby Dick exhibits both a metaphoric and fleshy nature for the reader. So, envisioned as both transcendental and embodied, Herzog's postscript suggests some sort of post-humanism. And also, the nuclear waste and the albinism of the non-human feature within this formulation. As Herzog says, not surprisingly, mutant albinos swim and breed in these waters. So Herzog's proposing that this radioactive material from the plant has affected these animals' bodies. And if we look into the future, he's saying that one day it might affect these bodies so much that they could understand cave art. This is when he says, fairly soon these albinos might reach Chauvet Cave, looking at the paintings, what will they make of them? So under this speculative line of thinking, Technics, so this is the nuclear waste and the artifacts in the Chauvet Cave, Technics is absorbed and understood by these irradiated alligators, as if they were perhaps to one day replace the human as the who in relation to the technical world. Having said that, though, the interpretation I just put forward is complicated by the very, very last sentence of the postscript. I'll come to that in a minute. Here Herzog moves away from the mutated alligator and returns to thinking about the human with greater specificity and greater attention to its embodiment. He says, are we today possibly the crocodiles who look back into an abyss of time when we see the paintings of Chauvet Cave? Herzog here is less interested in the crocodile at the end as he is with humans. So he's imagining the humans of today, us, living now, in this current nuclear epoch, as understanding as little about prehistory or prehistoric art as these reptiles. Bringing humanity into contact with the alligator, with this equalizing formulation, are we, Herzog's postscript even momentarily disrupts the vast unification of what Stiegler calls the immense we. Rather than seeing the paintings as communicating a techno-ontological connection between the prehistoric and contemporary who, Herzog's postscript might instead suggest that we, today, are in fact closer to crocodiles than we are to our prehistoric ancestors. And I realised as I was saying all that this slide was meant to come before. That's a map of the stuff. They're really far away. This is the website of the place. So, yeah, I missed that. But that's the, you know, kiddies thing, and this is their own website with come and see our albino alligator. So anyway. And that's what I was just saying. Are we them, is what Herzog seems to be saying. But beyond Herzog's fanciful irradiation narrative, there is in fact a third reading that I want to sort of bring out. This reading sort of comes from outside the film, outside the postscript itself, outside its speculative universe. And I'm here taking into account the real alligator. Once we do that, we realise quite quickly that this reptilian is indeed a more complex and mutated non-human animal than Herzog's narration immediately suggests. This is to say that due to the inscription of Technics onto the natural world, non-human animals are always irrevocably marked, and within this, Herzog's albino alligator must always already be both hybridized and mutated. And this is by no means an exhaustive list, but here are some examples. First, this alligator would have been moved, dislocated from natural habitat, probably in northern Africa, and moved to Louisiana. And then from there, it would have been bought by this French biosphere or theme park, and it would have been shipped over there. So, it has an originary displacement and then a secondary displacement. Secondly, the most recent biozoological studies suggest that albinism occurs more frequently in captive populations. So, this means that the very conditions of this alligator's displacement and rehousing actually increases the probability of its transformed genetic code. Moreover, the rarity of albino alligators in the wild is actually predominantly due to their singularity and hence vulnerability. As luminous white bodies, they have no natural means of camouflage. They are easier to be preyed upon when young, and for those that do make it into adult life, no one wants to mate with them. So, captivity and simulation, two distinctly human and hence technical endeavours, are therefore the unnatural irradiating phenomena that indeed transform and mutate these crocodilians' bodies. And if there's one thing that the critical work on this film has done so far, one critic, Catherine Lord, suggested that they should be called post-crocodiles. And I think that's a very good way of summing it up. What I'm suggesting then is that Herzog's tantalising postscript need not fabulate quite so extravagantly. He need not reach quite so far, because the truth is indeed stranger and perhaps here even more portentous than the fiction. In fact, the postscript is, I think, undone by this particular post-crocodile. As an anametaphor, something material and abstract, this albino is a metonym that presents a limit to Herzog's and, indeed, our own thought. It is incomprehensible, unreadable, and unthinkable just how radically Technics has mutated the natural world around it. And that includes this alligator. Herzog's fabricated scenario, then, does not come close to articulating the complexity of this individual life, both as a marker of human presence, but also as an individual life. So within the postscript, I'm sort of reading this alligator as a witness to inscription, as a witness to Technics over the course of the Anthropocene. Before I conclude, I'm just going to spell out what that means by way of a book called Crocodile. This is a book by Dan Wiley, published in 2013 as part of Reaction's Animal series. A pretty good series, even if quite slight. So in this book, Crocodile takes quite a global approach to the biological and cultural history of crocodilians. Ranging from the Nile to the Amazon, Wiley comprehensively surveys human-crocodile interactions through the ages. And he writes that crocodiles have been perennially, quote, I'm quoting now, worshipped, appealed to, represented, and treasured, albeit almost always with a tinge of fearfulness, end quote. So the final part of this points us towards what becomes a recurring motif in Wiley's short book, namely that crocodiles trigger in us, humans, an uncanny and disquieting fear. To quote again, even in our secular, technologized era, Wiley continues, crocodiles remain an unsettling reminder of humans' natural vulnerability, end quote. So, this affective reminder produced by the idea of a crocodile alone is perhaps motivated by two intersecting notions. First, crocodilians are one of the Earth's most extraordinary survivors. Current scientific research indicates that crocodilians have existed since the Eocene, some 55 million years ago. So our intellectualising of these reptiles is always bound up in a speculative and an imaginative space of prehistory. Secondly, and as a consequence of their permanence on Earth, our thinking about crocodiles often orients us back towards our own bodies, our own vulnerable flesh. It is not merely that crocodiles survive then, but that they are equally capable of ripping us apart. So when Wiley reaches the end of his book, it's not a surprise that his earlier tinge of fearfulness returns. This time, though, it's on a much larger scale. He concludes, one does not have to accept apocalyptic scenarios of humanity's demise to find it credible that, ultimately, the crocodiles might well outlive us. For Wiley, this particularly human fear is therefore threefold. Crocodilians have not only survived for the past 55 million years, and not only do they have the potential in the present to penetrate our bodies, but also, and more importantly, crocodiles might well continue to exist long after our departure, well into the Earth's post-human future. So it should be evident why Herzog's mutated albino alligators resonate the way they do. The postscript performs Wiley's complex threefold tinge of fearfulness with the alligator as a sort of prehistoric monster that threatens the order of both the film and of humanity. I'm reading the postscript then as something that opens up an imagined post-human space for the viewer to contemplate the shared vulnerability of the human and the non-human as Technics constantly leaps ahead of itself. For thinkers such as Derrida, Anat Pick, and even Judith Butler, this shared vulnerability across a sort of ontological caesura is the space where ethics begins. But I think that Herzog's postscript is less concerned with ethics as it is with showing the extent to which humanity has irrevocably changed the natural world. The postscript invites viewers to see a projection of a post-human planet, a world in which the nuclear might have destroyed the Anthropos, a world in which alligators might no longer be in captivity, a world in which these reptilians might be able to exchange gazes with one another, a world in which they might even look at and, bloody hell, even understand the prehistoric non-humans figured in the Chauvet Cave's paintings. Herzog's postscript thus takes Bataille's lecture on Lascaux to its logical conclusion, forecasting a world that is indeed reduced to humanity's material remains. Herzog's radioactive alligator imaginatively bears witness to Technics as a catastrophic pharmacon that has leapt ahead of itself and eliminated humanity. But although Herzog's creature survives long after the Anthropocene, its irradiated body, and even the post-human world in which it exists, is irrevocably written with humanity's trace or traces. The inscription of Technics necessarily extends beyond the human, now and forever. It remains. And this idea finds, I think, an uncanny articulation in the postscript's fabulated scenario. For here we are, in the Chauvet Cave, with an albino alligator that somehow can contemplate the entire human species through the inscriptions that we made on the cave walls. Herzog's postscript testifies, then, to the radical exteriorization of Technics by depicting a post-human future that is decidedly not post-script. The human is gone, but its presence remains, painted onto the cave and written into the alligator's genetic code. Thank you. It really does fit with a lot of the stuff that's going on, and particularly in sort of the confusing nature of it. But yeah.
To follow on actually a little bit from that about pressing you on sort of visual elements of it, I was very interested to see how at the beginning where you have those three cooling towers, and they're very, very light coloured and they have that sort of curve effect above a sort of horizon line. And I felt like when you watch the alligators, they're very much a similar shape and the only light thing in the foreground. And I wondered whether that was making...
I hadn't picked that up. That's really brilliant.
Thanks.
It's really brilliant.
I wonder whether what you describe at the end as kind of a world which is post-human but not post-script, on the other hand, whether some of the other stuff, particularly the philosophical material you've been looking at, doesn't imply the impossibility of the post-human ever being, ever the post-human epoch ever coming into being, because if the human kind of begins with script, and this script, according to Bataille, already imagines the apocalypse, well, the apocalypse is something which is always, like script, is this thing which is always, by its very definition, deferred. And so script is what kind of outlasts the human. On one hand, I just completely agree with you that script can exist beyond the human. But if the human comes into being with script, firstly, will that apocalypse ever come? Because we might talk about ecological apocalypse, but the kind of the final disappearance of the human. But also, if the human and script are kind of concomitant, then the continuation of the script is the continuation of the human in some way.
Yeah, and I think there might be some confusion in my piece about precisely sort of disarticulating those two as they sort of transition into the future. I mean, yeah, totally. The human lives on through script. But I think what I'm trying to do here when I'm referencing the sort of the work on posthumanism, and actually in the wider piece, it is sort of interrogation of some of that on a much larger scale, but particularly the stuff on Wolf, it's about embeddedness. So it's about an actual living thing. What my idea of living on for the human would be it lives on in a completely different way, one which doesn't mean an embeddedness. But I realise that's not a good answer to the question.
I think it is a good answer, but I guess sort of one thing seems to be that one of the implications that you brought out very well there is that perhaps we're already, it doesn't seem to quite cut it that we're already post-human, despite what kind of Herzog's kind of suggesting there, but that somehow this kind of deferral of the human just seems to just be a kind of endless mutation of the human, which is kind of technical by its very nature. But we're not like the humans of the cave paintings. But that doesn't mean that we're post-human in relationship to them, because humanity here is defined by the very fact that it defers. But if we're always in apocalypse, then we're already kind of deferring our humanity whilst at the same time retaining it.
And I guess I wonder what. I guess the two biggest names there are Bataille and Stiegler in my thing, and I wonder what they'd say about that in a way, because Bataille would certainly he'd be talking about that deferral a lot.
Well, I was very struck by that phrase, the limit of this unlimited destiny.
Yeah.
So it's the limit of something which by definition can't be limited. It's,
yeah. But when you read Stiegler, there's a lot of not maybe sadness, there is some sort of end that might come when you read his work.
Sorry, Natalia, and then
Natalia, you can make it. I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on what you were talking about with Judith Butler and kind of vulnerability, and how vulnerability is a space where ethics comes into play, and also you were just talking about sadness and whether, because kind of vulnerability kind of implies a hopelessness. And there's a bit of a kind of paradoxical relationship between this idea of hopelessness and an ethics that you can use to build on and have people kind of.
Yeah, and I mean that might be a problem of their work actually, and which Butler is it? It's one of the two that came out in the late 2010s.
Frames of War.
Frames of War. Yeah, it's a passing reference in Butler. So I think there she's sort of trying to get a sort of affect studies thing, affect theory thing going, and she is talking about a sort of solidarity through vulnerability. And I think it's in the introduction where she kind of mentions we might want to expand this to look at our relationship with other species. But that's more articulated in Anat Pick's work, Creaturely Poetics, which is about that. That is what it concerns. For Anat Pick, it's not a space of sadness. Although I would be, I'd be interested to read a critique on it based on a sort of if you're on the defensive, as in, It's not a forward-looking thing. It's an inward, backward. Yeah, I'd be interested to read something like that. But and I think it'd be perhaps the same for Butler. I could probably mount that at her as well in that sense. But I don't think they have those people who, and even Derrida and The Animal That Therefore I Am. It's not, or Beast and the Sovereign. Actually, more importantly, it's not about a sadness. There's very little emotion that comes into this vulnerability, because it's just about can we die? Can we be hurt?
Yeah, we had a question over here.
Yeah, sorry, I've still got quite unformed thoughts. I thinking about the kind of the layering of the sort of explicative tone Herzog's got, you know, here is a power station, and then what you were also, you know, you're sort of re-explaining, and I was sort of wondering, there was this moment where you said, oh, you know, there aren't, obviously there are hundreds of alligators, and I realised that I didn't think that was obvious, and it might only be obvious if you sort of have done the, you found out the kind of, you know, the secret that actually this isn't, you know, that this is actually a kid's crocodile sanctuary, not what he's saying it is, and so on. And then so this kind of refracting of what was going, it makes it quite complicated for me to think through, particularly since the tie as well. But I was thinking, you know, you've got these three sites, the sort of the Chauvet Cave, the nuclear power plant, and the crocodile sanctuary, and there's such a lot going on with your three readings about how these three different loci represent, you know, a past, a present, a future, or a subject, techne and pharmacos or something, and the kind of the possibility that these crocodiles were always cyborg even before they got washed over by warm,
radioactive
water or whatever. And that obviously the same goes for us or whatever. But I thought, yeah, I was pretty moved, I suppose, by this idea that, the crocodiles crawling into the cave that we've only just discovered is sort of our vulnerable ancestry or whatever, with these markings that could be sort of rendered legible to a species more equipped kind of cope with the apocalypse we've created. Anyway, that's actually not a question.
Well, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly, it's even more jarring when you've just watched the 90 minutes of humans walking around a cave, talking about a cave. It's a 95-minute film. This is the end, and it's completely like, not linked to what's gone before. I mean, as that cello comes in and rises at the end, like, it's quite moving. It's batshit, but it's quite moving. Yeah. And when you have it immediately following this question he puts to the guy, what constitutes humanness, it's quite weird, and I mean, it's certainly, you know, for me at least, it was influential enough, a weirdness, that I was like, I really want to look at that for a whole summer, you know.
Is this postscript in 3D like the rest of the film? Uh-huh. So do you have to whip your glasses off at the end? No, it's all in 3D.
But I've never seen the film in 3D, I have no idea how good it is. I mean, people have said that it's one of the only mainstream 3D releases that's not horrible to sit through. there's a sort of a loving use of the cave walls, the pulsating sort of rock formations that actually lend themselves to 3D in a way which, because I think 2010 might even been the same year that Avatar was released, might have been. So, you know, it's quite interesting that it would come out along the same time, but I haven't seen it in 3D.
Yeah. Sorry, I was late, by the way. Something I wanted to say that is similarly with the caveat of unformed thoughts and potentially interlocking ignorances as well, because I haven't seen the entire feature. It just struck me when the discussion of the crocodiles seeing the paintings, another reading I would be tempted to make of it would be, for me, the post-human is the point at which we can no longer recognize those paintings, because what we've become ceases to be this centralization of subjectivity and skill and control that is so potentiated in the obsessive recreation of the apocalypse again, a lot of pop culture, which is entirely about the reproduction of skill, subjectivity, family, control,
within a world in which capitalism has been suspended and destroyed, and we could roam about the world killing zombies or like
yep.
avoiding barbarians, but in such a way that we get to be people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think about the crocodile, and I think what you said about its kind of pre-existence, and I think, well, couldn't you also think about the crocodile as a testament to why it's pointless to evolve subjectivity? Because it's 55 billion years of consistency and a reptilian brain, and no, at any point, commitment towards representative art. And that will probably stay the same. And so you think, maybe, isn't he also grieving with this crocodile, right? Which is a weird sentence to say. Isn't he like trying to kind of like reposition someone that could see these paintings and understand them with this notion of a mutated, as you say,
mm.
by human agency, remainder?
Mm.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I think the same. I had a thought halfway through, but it's gone. It'll come back to me though. If you want to.
Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. actually, it was a. Yeah. I agree, but I'd sort of want to look at Herzog's filmography and see where that's reproduced or not, and I don't know. He privileges the human so much, and privileges the human over the animal so much that I'd find it hard to like to get behind to really get behind a point which is saying that he's sort of. I mean, I got the impression that there might be some sort of like they've got it right. We don't.
For some reason, I'm thinking about the penguin that goes mad in Accounts of the End of the World.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and this kind of remainder of humanity within, like, an inner, underprivileged animal, right? Like, big.
No, that certainly fits with this, because I imagine Herzog would be saying that the penguins are like these, doing pretty well. But it's the moment in which they become human. This is the madness of the penguin, in which that's the very moment in which it's worth filming and worth
yeah.
getting annoyed or sad or whatever about. And because in that bit, Herzog wants to stop the penguin, if I remember rightly, but the scientist is just like, you just have to let them run and die.
I have a question about kind of discourses on the Anthropocene more broadly and how you square these different approaches. So there's a very big question in discussions of the Anthropocene about periodization. So when does what is the moment in human history that makes this an irreversible phenomenon? And people place that all over the place, you know.
Timothy Morton says it's like, it's the first steam engine.
Yeah, right.
It's just like,
yeah.
Right, okay.
No, it was some time before that, I think. it seems to be a very important gesture to place the beginning of the Anthropocene as an irreversible phenomenon at the outset of capitalism or the outset of the underlying forces of social development that led to what we now call capitalism.
Yeah.
So I wonder how I don't know if I have a question exactly, but it's interesting to encounter a sort of approach to the Anthropocene which could say that it was all there at Chauvet, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
what does
I'd
that do
probably say it wasn't,
yeah.
because capitalism, but but Bernard Stiegler. I mean, that's his shtick.
Mm.
That it happens because the human is, because technics is with the human. Because he doesn't use the word Anthropocene in his work, though. He uses his own coinage. I think it's the Entropocene. So it is entropy. This moment is just entropy. So, I mean, that's definitely where I sort of am taking the theoretical framework for this, but I mean, outside of this paper, I mean, yeah, I mean, like, I definitely not suggest, just for a political point, like, just because of, yeah, just because politics, like, I'd be more inclined to suggest capitalism than anything else. It seems more vital to do it like that.
There's a kind of interesting question in all of what's kind of going around here, which is the difference between kind of technically marking non-human animals and technically marking technically altering kind of geological processes and things. And I wonder whether there's kind of fundamental differences between that our kind of technical alterations of non-human animals begin at least with the beginning of recorded civilization of any sort, if not before then, whereas our technical alterations to kind of geological processes probably begins in a meaningful way much later. Because we conceptualized the crocodile particularly as being geological in some way, because it reminds us of fossils, it reminds us of dinosaurs, then the crocodile becomes this very interesting, the crocodile is actually a kind of hybrid in some way between the animal and the geological as well.
Yeah, that's really, really brilliant. And it makes me think of John Berger's work on animals and on art, and he whilst I disagree with him, he kind of writes with that divide in mind. So he wrote two essays about the Chauvet Cave. Well, they're not essays actually; they're both contained in short story collections, and they're very short pieces addressed to women, and he's like, I went to the Chauvet Cave today. But he's there talking about the representation of animals as opposed to this sort of geological inscription. But it comes into contact. And I think the alligator certainly fits both categories really, really, really well. And I'm probably going to steal that point.
May I ask what it is that you don't agree with Berger in looking at animals?
Yeah, so he identifies basically, Berger's like a sort of a primitivist.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not. So that's it,
okay.
I guess. Like, so he's like, he's okay with us going back to old practices of like farming and stuff, but it's just like doesn't really work. I don't think it'd really work now. Yeah, I haven't answered that right, really. But like, very simply, that's what he says. Not just in Why Look at Animals, but like since then in his work on animals, or at least his work which touches on animals, which is what most likely is happening with Berger.
Thanks.
Any final questions? No, going, gone. Okay.